Are you a financial advisor considering the independent RIA model and wondering where to start? Start with Schwab Advisor Services. They've helped thousands evaluate the full range of options and can help you determine your best path forward. Start your journey today at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center left to center right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. We do not have a special guest this week. And that is because this is going to be a different Beg to Differ. In fact, this is our final installment. The world is changing and we are changing with it. For 5 years, we've analyzed the news of the week every week. And we hope that you found it informative and useful. But with the advent of a second Trump term, I at least don't want to focus so much on the daily circus. So this is, as I said, the last episode of Beg to Differ. But please stay tuned to your feed, because in January, I will be returning with a different podcast that will be a one-on-one discussion format that will allow me to go more in depth on a single topic per episode. The state of our families, whether neoliberalism was a failure, the plight of boys and men in today's society, health challenges in the modern world, Israel's history and conflicts, whether the middle class really has stagnated over the past 30 years, the role of religion in our politics, and how to preserve small L liberalism in a time of challenge. Those are among the topics that we have teed up, and you may even see some Beg to Differ regulars pop up from time to time. And speaking of our regulars, I want to say right off the top that you all have been fantastic colleagues over these past 5 years, unfailingly thoughtful, informed, and insightful. And so with that, let us turn to our format for this week. Oh, wait, before we do that, I want to play a clip that our intrepid producer, Jim Swift, found, which is apparently from our very first episode. So let's hear that, Jim. This is Beg to Differ, and I am Mona Charon, joined today and in the future by Linda Chavez, Bill Galston, and Damon Linker. Welcome, one and all. This is going to be a roundtable discussion. It's going to model civil disagreement and a little bit of a deeper dive into, we hope, into some of the issues that face us, rather than the surface analysis that is that proliferates on the internet and, of course, on cable TV. So welcome, one and all, and let's jump right in. There are a few things going on.
Understatement of the year.
All right. Well, there are still a few things going on. So let us begin this week with Bill Galston. Your reflections.
Yeah, well, I just have been thinking about, you know, not what is going on right now, but what has happened over the full five-year arc. And it's really remarkable when you think about it. You know, when we began in October of 2019, you know, Donald Trump was riding high. The pandemic had not yet begun. Mm-hmm. We did not have the chaos of 2020, followed by the post-election tumult that culminated in the events of January 6th. We hadn't had Bidenomics or the invasion of Ukraine, or any of the events that eventually return Donald Trump to power for a second term that will begin next month. If one of us had written a short story about these 5 years with all of those events, you know, not to mention a couple of assassination attempts against former President Trump during the 2024 election, I could go on and on and on. I think the imaginative short story written in October of 2019 wouldn't have gotten close,
right?
You know, to capturing, you know, the extraordinary events of the past 5 years, which I think have left the country a little breathless, which actually raises a very interesting question about the year or 2 years to come. You know, Mr. Trump believes, and the people around him believe, you know, that he was not elected to bring stability to the system, but rather to blow up substantial pieces of it. I wonder whether that's what the American people really want after the tumult of the past 5 years. I think there's already evidence from surveys that I've been looking at that substantial portions of the president's emerging program for the first 100 days, or maybe even the first day, are a little bit too bold and destabilizing for most of the people to stomach. And so I think in the next year or two, we're going to find out whether why Donald Trump was elected a month ago was why he thinks he was elected. You know, whether the American people and Donald Trump are on the same wavelength when it comes to the speed and depth of the changes that they're looking for, as opposed to the ones that he's contemplating. Just, you know, obviously, it seems to me that as we end this arc of 5 years, you know, we should at least think about some questions that might frame the politics and culture of the next year or two. 5 years is beyond our poor powers to add or detract, I'm sure.
Yeah,
that's my opening reflection.
Thanks for that, Damon. This makes me smile a little bit because it reminds me, and we have to find our amusement wherever we can in these dark days. So Bill has reminded me that when he said, why was Trump elected? Why does Trump think he was elected, reelected this time? I think of the interview that he gave to Kristen Welker of NBC. And he was saying, groceries, said, it's a simple word, groceries. I like to say groceries. And the way he put it, you know, it's just like he came up with this clever term for the stuff you buy at the supermarket that only he uses anyway. But then, having said that, having given the, you know, rising price of groceries full credit for his reelection, a couple weeks later, he was saying, of course, you know, having throughout the campaign said that he was going to bring down prices. He says, oh, by the way, it's really hard. You can't bring down prices.
Well, short of inspiring deflation, which I think would be accompanied by a bunch of other stuff that wouldn't make him particularly popular. Yeah, it is hard. The prices don't usually come down once they've gone up. The question is, he's coming into office at the current baseline. So if inflation stays under control, the memory of the price hikes of the middle of the Biden administration will fade and Trump will not get blamed for them. The question, though, is, you know, what's with all this tariff talk and other forms of protectionism that could very well produce a kind of resurgence of inflation for very different reasons than the ones we had 2 or 3 years ago. And if that happens, then there'll be a whole round of blame that he'll have to take on for himself, though he will no doubt try to deflect it, as he always does. We shall see, as in everything. I think it's very maximally uncertain right now. One way in which I've sort of, along with your opening remarks, Mona, about change and moving on to different kind of podcasting options for yourself with the new administration coming in, I think it's good for us to take a moment and think as journalists and intellectuals, writers, how we're going to cover this incoming Trump administration and how it should maybe differ than the way we covered it the last time, how we've covered Biden. And my own view, which I wrote about this week, is basically my rule of thumb is going to be I am not going to respond to what Trump says. Usually, if he's, giving a major speech with a massive audience, of course, I will cover that. But those are the moments where Trump is most scripted and he has a staff, like all presidents, who give him prepared remarks. And if he behaves the way he did through most of his first term, he will stick to that script, at least for the limited time frame of the actual remarks being delivered. But all of the stuff that we lived through during the first Trump administration of like following social media tweets, posts, offhanded, unscripted remarks at press conferences on the tarmac, and being part of the media, and at the time for most of that first, well, actually for all of that first term, I was a columnist 3 times a week for the week. And so I had, I had deadlines to meet. And it was always easy in those years. There was always something to write about because there was always a 3:30 a.m. deranged sounding emanation from the residents in the White House that the president is saying he's going to do X, Y, and Z insane sounding thing.
Yeah.
Not only is that exhausting, but in the end, I think the net result is a decrease in our understanding about what is actually happening in the world. I don't think he necessarily does those things for the purpose of keeping everyone confused and unable to focus, but the net result nevertheless is something like that. And so I'm resolving to ignore much of what the man says. I will cover what his administration does. If he says he's going to go out and round up 11 million illegal immigrants and put them in camps, I will pause and wait to see if the administration actually does that, how it gets implemented, and how it responds to the inevitable blowback in the courts and in public opinion and possible street protests. That I will cover because that's real. Trump saying he's going to do stuff it's real in the sense that it's still a bully pulpit and it has effects in the world, but I would actually like those effects to be a little less pronounced. I think we need some resolve to sort of keep our composure a little bit more and focus on the actual things that are happening at the level of what the government is doing, not what this man, who is a demagogue and gets his power by whipping up public opinion, by convincing his most fervent admirers that he's doing exactly what they want, when in effect, sometimes nothing like that ever actually materializes. So that's at least how I'm going to go about trying to keep my sanity and increase our net understanding of the world this time around.
Linda, that strikes me as great advice. And I was thinking very much along the same lines about not reacting to what he says, but more to what he and his administration does. But there are exceptions. So when he makes direct threats against individuals, that I think cannot be permitted to go uncommented upon. Because the I mean, for what it's worth, I do think that he spews out all of this garbage as a way to keep other people on their, you know, confused and on the back foot and, you know, reacting all the time. And he's always got more, you know, and it's an endless supply of outrage that he can provide. But if, as president of the United States, he is, you know, threatening individuals or maligning individuals or whatever, that I think those times you have to speak up. What do you think?
Well, I was just about to beg to differ with Damon.
No.
So,
good.
You know, on the one hand, I absolutely agree. The only positive outcome of the end of beg to differ for me is that I will not have to spend endless hours reading every single article I can get my hands on about every outrage in Trump world and watching just way too much cable news. So that'll be good. And I think that taking a breather and not reacting at everything is a good idea. However, even before he has taken the oath of office this week alone, he has derailed a bipartisan agreement on the budget. And I think that, you know, is dangerous. The government, by the time this show airs, I guess we'll know whether or not the government has shut down. But that kind of chaos is not good. And I am a little less sanguine about what's going to happen in the immigration world. As everyone knows, that this is my, you know, single issue that I focus so much of my attention on and have over my career written so much about. And just the fact of these threatened enforcement actions is causing tremendous upheaval in the world of people who do not have a full legal right to be in the United States, but on whom we absolutely depend for getting food on our table, to keeping our country working, to providing essential services. So, you know, I understand, and I read a friend of the podcast, Brett Stevens' column this week in the New York Times, in which he scolded the Never Trumpers, which he was part of at one time, basically saying, you know, quit being hysterical, stop acting like the, you know, the sky is falling and democracy is going to end. I take a little bit of that. I mean, I do think that when I look back on all of the prosecutions of Trump, you know, this week as well, the appeals court of the state of Georgia has disqualified Fannie Willis from continuing her prosecution case, her whole office, not just her personally. And I do think that there was so much piling on that people basically tuned it out. So I think, you know, toning some of that down is good. But I expect chaos. I expect that we are going to have the kind of circus that you want to avoid having to deal with every week once Trump takes office. So I think we have to be a little cautious about hoping that we can manage this. When you look at the people he's going to bring in, he's trying to bring in, and it's looking more and more like most of them are going to get through the nomination and process in the Senate or the, you know, the Senate being able to advise and consent on those nominations. So I don't know. I'm girding for a rough ride over the next year, at least.
So correct me if I'm wrong, Damon, but I didn't take you to be saying you expected less than chaos. I took you to be saying you're not going to, you know, rise to the bait every time Trump says something outrageous. You're going to look more at his actions.
Right, right. And the actions include who he appoints to the cabinet and other and other non-cabinet appointments like Russ Vaught. His appointment as OMB director, I think, is extremely alarming. I might write something on that specific appointment, which hasn't gotten much attention. I'm going to do something early in the year on him and his ambitions, kind of the whole schedule F, you know, danger of gutting the nonpartisan civil service is probably, it looks like, going to emanate from Russ Vought if he gets in. And that's, I think, something we need to be looking at very closely, in addition to Kash Patel and just all these people who, I mean, the weird thing is Trump, in his rhetoric while running this time, a lot of the time sounded a little more moderate than he did, you know, 4 years ago and 8 years ago. But his appointments are far more unhinged than he was the last time. Last time, the administration was mostly staffed with sort of, you know, normie Republicans, because that's all there was in the party at the time, because he was leading a revolution. Well, it's 8 years into that revolution, and this cast of characters is, you know, runs the gamut from, I think, you know, hyper-partisan lunatics like Kash Patel to, who shouldn't even be allowed to have a position because Christopher Wray is supposed to be FBI director for several more years, and he's capitulated to this by resigning. So that's all bad. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you have the kind of loony, non-partisan populist impulse by RFK and Tulsi Gabbard, who are sort of coming in as this, I guess, vision of populist realignment, sort of like the what I've called in other contexts the sort of island of misfit toys political movement. So like anyone who just hates the status quo, who hates the institutions, who hates the elites, no matter where you come from on the spectrum, you can kind of join the party. Trump has sprinkled those types throughout the administration too, and his nominees at least. So yeah, lots to write about and focus on, and I will be certainly doing all of that. It's the emanations of the guy himself, his sort of impulse to just lash out and make threats. And I agree with your point too, Mona, of course. If he makes threats, especially about specific individuals, just like his you know, logorrhea of lawsuits, just, you know, he's gonna sue the Iowa pollster, Ann Seltzer, because she, you know, published a really crappy poll. No doubt it was crappy, but like that's not something you sue over. In fact,
in the dispensation, this is illegal. You may not publish a poll that is critical of the great leader.
If anything, it helped him because it panicked Republicans who showed up. It's just the whole thing is absurd. So, yes.
This is not America.
My general rule of thumb is just like less time focusing on the 3 a.m. unhinged tweets. That's all.
Yeah, let's go to Bill.
Yeah, I have a somewhat different take. I've been thinking hard about this because it's something, it seems to me, that also implicates, you know, the forward strategy of the Bulwark as an enterprise, right? Because presumably, you know, you're not simply aiming, you know, at, you know, aesthetic excellence or even just expanding viewership. It's also an enterprise that is political in the good sense and has objectives, honorable objectives. But I think we all have to ask ourselves, what kind of behavior as intellectuals, as journalists, as commentators, as what have you, is most conducive to the attainment of those objectives? And I think I can say, without fear of contradiction, that the effort to characterize Donald Trump as a threat to democracy, whatever the truth of that line of argument, has demonstrated its lack of political efficacy. Maybe somebody wants to disagree with that, but if that had been an efficacious line of argument, we'd be looking at a different kind of presidential transition to a different administration. We've all made that argument. It was Kamala Harris's closing argument. And there's evidence to suggest that the people who were late deciders broke in the other direction, not in her direction. So that closing argument, at the very least, did not work for the people who were still capable of going one way or the other. So let me tell you what I'm going to do until I'm forced out of this strategy. I am going to treat Donald Trump as someone who went from 47% to 50%, not because the MAGA movement had expanded, but because the people who made the difference in the election hired him to do a very specific kind of job, to accomplish specific sorts of tasks that they, the swing voters, considered to be important. Many of those tasks were economic in nature. Some had to do with immigration, although I think that Donald Trump is in grave danger of outrunning his real mandate on that subject. Some had to do with cultural issues. People are expecting him to do certain things, and I'm going to be covering the extent to which he actually does those things. Because there is nothing as consequential in politics as promising people you're going to do something and then failing to do it. If he succeeds in doing those things, then it is more than likely that he'll be able to pass on the Oval Office to his designated successor, if he has a designated successor. So I'm going to focus on Donald Trump, not as an abnormal president, but however strange it may sound, as a normal president who has made promises to the people who helped him get his majority and is now on the spot to honor those promises.
Linda, you mentioned a few minutes ago that the Congress is currently in turmoil because Trump, or I think it was you who said, you know, threw a wrench into these negotiations, or the agreement. Actually, they had an agreement for a stopgap spending bill, and now it's all blown up. So you didn't mention Elon Musk's role in this, because it originated with Elon Musk, and then Trump, you know, repeated it. But so we now have our great overlord, the billionaire oligarch, deciding to shut down the government on a whim. I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, as a conservative, I hate chaos. I think things should run well. I am very much a status quo. I have a status quo bias. I can confess that, but this is not like the showdowns over the debt ceiling, where if you don't come to an agreement, like, we're going to have to default on our debts and, you know, people are going to go hungry. I mean, those aren't the stakes.
So that will come in the spring.
Yes. Right. But this is just a government shutdown. We've been through them before. But when admittedly, Democrats still technically are in charge of the Senate, but everybody knows that this is being orchestrated by the incoming Republicans. And if they shut down the government when they're in charge of everything, I say, great. Great. That's a perfect symbol of the kind of governing you're going to get from this crew. So let it rip. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I, like you, Mona, I used to think, well, shut down the government. What's the big deal?
No, I don't want to be misunderstood. Hmm. It's very bad to shut down the government. Okay. I don't like government shutdowns.
But
I want
people.
No, my point is, I want people to see the maladministration they just voted for.
Okay. Well, all right. Maybe. I'm going to sort of use that and go off on a tangent on Elon Musk, because I think that is also part of this whole story, because you're absolutely right. Yeah. It's when he took to X and riled up, you know, millions of people to start objecting to what was a Christmas bill. But all of these bills at the end of the year are Christmas bills. They do stick a lot of things on there. And sometimes it's because they had to. Did they have
because they don't do any they other don't bills do any during the year.
Right. Exactly.
This is their last chance.
Exactly. Correct. They don't, you know, I don't know, does the RFK Stadium, I guess I'd like to see it, you know, be given to the district. But really, does that have to be on the end of the year bill? Probably not. Okay. But there's another issue here, and that is the role of the oligarchs that we've called them before, and Elon Musk, who's the number one oligarch, both because he's the richest man in the world, but also because he apparently is in Mar-a-Lago, and I don't know if he's going to move permanently into the Lincoln bedroom in the White House or what, but
I think he might move into Trump's bedroom.
Well, I don't know what. Yeah, well, I suppose Melania probably isn't there anyway, but yeah, that's really that for a different kind of show we can talk about. But I do think that this is not going to wear well with Trump. There's one thing that Trump hates, and that is anybody else being given credit for or receiving more attention than he does. And so it is going to be sort of interesting to see what kind of role that Musk is going to play going forward. And while he acts like Trump acts like he, you know, he views Musk almost like a son or you know, the son he wished he had, I don't think it's going to last. But it does raise a really serious question that we've talked on the program before. And that is, you know, the role of these private players like Musk and Ramaswamy and others who have business with the government, who make a great deal of money off of that business, or like Musk, who's taken huge bailouts, government bailouts in the past for his businesses. That reeks of a kind of corrupt system that, you know, we are, you know, more used to seeing in other countries, and we have not seen in large measure in the United States. And I think that poses a serious problem.
What's the best way to learn a new language? Immersion. Just being thrown in the deep end in a new country and having to learn it every single minute of every day. But since that's not going to be the experience for most of us, the next best way is Babbel. Now, one in five Americans have already put learn a new language on their bucket list. If that's you, make 2025 the year you finally check it off the list with Babbel. Did you know that learning actually makes a sound? It's true. Babbel has a little ding that tells you you've done the right thing. Plus, it's interactive. You speak and then you listen. And it is almost like being in a room with a native speaker. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. If you are planning business travel and you're going to a country and you want to be able to say a few phrases, or even if you're just planning on a vacation, or if you work in an environment where you need to be able to have basic conversations with people who whose English is not perfect, you can be ready and speaking within just a few weeks using Babbel every day. Studies from Yale, Michigan State, and others continue to prove that Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for a mere 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. With over 16 million subscriptions sold, Babbel is the number one language learning tool on the internet. Here is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get 50% off a one-time payment for a lifetime Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/beg to differ. Get 50% off at babbel.com/
beg to differ. That's spelled BABBEL.com/beg to differ. Rules and restrictions may apply. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about drones. We have had a mini hysteria in this country over the past week, that has not just included, people, you know, random people on X or other social media sites, claiming to see things or whatever, spreading this, this contagion. But we've had Larry Hogan and other sort of, you know, reasonable, supposedly well-informed people joining in. Larry Hogan thought he had seen drones over his house in Maryland. Turned out he was looking at the constellation Orion. You know, and the government kept saying, well, we really don't see anything. Can't really explain what people think they're seeing. And of course, Trump jumps into this because he loves nothing more than a good conspiracy that he can stoke. And so he pops off saying that, yeah, the government knows full well what's going on and they're not telling us. And, you know, they need to shoot these things down. So guess what? Pilots are being harassed now by people pointing their laser pointers at what they think are drones, but are actually airplanes. I would like to get all of your reflections, Damon. I'll start with you about what this says about where we are as a society. How mature of a country are we? or maybe you think I'm wrong and that there really are drones, and in which case, have at it. I mean, there are drones, but a drone attack.
You mean I get to go first on this? Wow, what a what a gift. I don't have like very strong opinions about this because I find the whole thing kind of ridiculous. This is an example of something that I've obviously been aware is a story because I keep seeing it talked about, but I deliberately sort of scan over it because I am innately skeptical enough that anything that smells of a conspiracy theory, I tend to just sort of instinctually tune it out. And This is one of those stories. You know, drones are a huge deal. And when it comes to defense posture and policy, I think are incredibly important. The face of warfare is being changed. And if, God forbid, knock on wood, if we happen to get involved in a real war in the next generation, maybe with China, I think we're going to have trouble recognizing how it is waged because of drones and other robotic forms of combat that are going to really change a lot. So that this is a huge topic. And in the context of that, the fear that all those blinking lights I see in the sky is maybe like China sending a swarm of drones over highly populated areas of our country just to see how we react and can they get away with it? And if they had bombs on them, maybe they could bomb Newark and Paterson, New Jersey and Weehawken and like do that without like anyone shooting them down first. Like I can see how one's mind could start skipping and jumping ahead, but it's almost certainly just nonsense. I mean, especially in that part of the country, because I mean, I'm from the New York area originally and like Newark Airport, they're like Newark, JFK, LaGuardia. You got three major international airports within like 5 miles of each other. And then you have like 9 small regional airports with lots of private jets, rich people taking off and landing nearby. Plus you have the port there, which has large towers with lights on them. And then just in general, a lot of ambient light in the area because you have New York City and then you have Newark, New Jersey, and a lot of people. It's pretty much the most densely populated part of the country. And Yeah, if you look up in the sky in that context, you're going to see stuff flying around. And then you got Larry Hogan not realizing what Orion's belt looks like. And actually, because we are blessed with social media, he goes and humiliates himself before the whole world by saying he thinks it's spaceships or whatever. I'll leave it at that, because I mean, again, under it, because of the underlying defense issue with drones, I give some credence to being a little worried about drones and how they could show up, surprise attack, that kind of thing, because it could happen someday. This isn't that. This is a kind of mass hysteria. And if anyone wants to speculate about why it's happening now, my blessings.
So, Bill, let me just mention before you get into this that part of the explanation for how it went so viral is that Joe Rogan posted about it on X, and it was viewed 30 million times. Okay. Where and his was quite extensive. It was like, these drones are searching for missing nukes that 80 nuclear weapons that were supposedly lost when Ukraine separated from the USSR. I mean, a whole elaborate bullshit story. Sorry, but there we are. Okay.
Yeah. Well,
Bill.
Look, what we're witnessing is the latest consequence of the collapse of trust.
Yeah.
That's the real issue. And, I could go into endless detail on this, but let me just cite you the latest piece of evidence. Gallup came out with a survey yesterday showing a 24-point decline in public trust in the judiciary, which was the last remaining branch of government that had any trust at all. And so
I think people still trust the military, right?
Well, no. But I'm talking about a branch of government. The military is still up there, but just about everything else has collapsed. And in a trust-free environment, conspiracy theories flourish. It does not help, I would add, if the government of the United States has nothing to say while this whole conspiratorial thesis, it's not just one theory, it's a bunch of them, is allowed to develop and fill the available space, right? One lesson for government is that if you don't want to be overwhelmed by conspiracy theories, you've got to get in there with the truth fast. By fast, I mean within 24 hours and not a week. Because if government can't figure out how to move at the pace of social media, then governance as a whole is going to be very difficult to sustain. And I don't care who's in charge of the government. So for me, looking forward, thinking about the country, not just the Trump administration, the great question before us is what it is going to take to get out of this vicious descending spiral, of less and less trust in anything, and to set in motion a contrary trend. Which brings me to a topic that I do think that we should talk about. There are, after all, two political parties in the United States. Both of them have agency. One is in power, the other is in crisis. And the question is, what will Democrats do in response to this crisis? I have a lot of thoughts on the subject. I'm just going to put that topic on the table now, but I will return to it if I have a chance later in the podcast.
Linda, on the subject of government getting ahead of a story like this within 24 hours, I mean, I take Bill's point, and I do think that some of this is down to Joe Biden being completely absent. I mean, he is just sort of a cipher at this point, and was never, let's face it, even when he was at his best in his presidency,
he never inhabited the office in the way that others have. And it always seemed too big for him. And he's just not a good talker. So you need a good talker as a leader. But I'm not so sure that any leader, even a Pete Buttigieg, let's say, who's a good talker, I'm not sure he could have gotten ahead of this because, you know, the world we live in now is just, you know, is fueled by this, you know, sort of information profusion without any gatekeepers. And so rumors are in the saddle and they can just ride. And, you know, the old saying about, you know, the falsity goes halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on.
Right.
It seems to be what we're living with.
Well, I absolutely agree. And by the way, I have a theory about why this started.
Oh, okay.
And
go
certainly
for it.
It relates to Joe Rogan, too. And I will start with a little story about my oldest son, David. In the early 1970s, I was a graduate student at UCLA and lived in Westwood in Los Angeles. And one night I took my son out to the grocery store and I got him out of his car seat and he looked up in the sky and he saw all of these lights, which he had never seen before. That's because in the early 1970s in Los Angeles, pollution was
smoggy.
So awful.
Oh my gosh. Never,
so he had no idea what they were. And I had to explain to him they were stars.
Wow.
So my theory about how this started is most of the people who, you know, started fueling this have their noses in their iPhones 24/7. They're always looking down. They never look up. And my theory is it was probably a bright and clear night the first time the first influencer noticed these lights in the sky that they had never seen because they'd never looked up. And so then they started talking about it. And you know, you end up with cable news proliferating. It reminds me, I grew up in the 1950s in New Mexico. You know, I went through the whole UFO craze. We would go out every night and look to see if we could see UFOs. And then, of course, prior to that, there was the War of the Worlds, Orson Welles episode of War of the Worlds on the radio, which made everybody think that we were being invaded by Martians.
Linda, I happen to know that that predates you. I'm just going to put that out there.
just a little bit, despite the way here. It's a little before my time. But at any rate, the point is that, you know, it's like Shark Week and, you know, one person gets bit by a shark someplace in the world. And then, you know, everybody is down in the ocean looking for sharks. And there is a way in which these kinds of stories proliferate. And I'm really sorry to hear about Larry Hogan discovering Orion in that way, because I love looking up and I happen to have, you know, some rural property. So I actually get to see the sky and all year round and whenever it's a clear night. But that's my unsophisticated take on how this happened. Joe Rogan took his nose out of his iPhone and looked up at the sky. And now we have this. So,
yeah. So I don't know. I don't want this to sound sort of new agey or anything, but it does happen to be the truth that I wake up every morning before dawn and I almost every morning and I go out and collect the newspapers from the front of the house. And actually a few years ago, even long before we were doing this podcast, I remember telling Bill Galston where, I don't know, we met at some event or something. And I said, oh, you know, I've canceled my subscriptions to my newspapers. I'm just going to read everything online. And he said, you will regret that. You'll miss things. And sure enough, I did. And I wound up getting the newspapers delivered again. But so every morning I go outside in the dark to get my newspapers. And I always, aren't clouds, I always look up because it's a big, wide universe out there and you catch a glimpse of it and it has a centering effect. It makes you take a deep breath and I don't know, just look at the beauty of nature. This episode is evidence of a lamentable human tendency to just want to believe in fantasies, right? But So I have a negative interpretation of it. I have to say my friend David French had a more gentle interpretation of it, which was that there are so many ways in which our modern life sort of deprives us of magic and of believing in, you know, miraculous things. And that maybe this is a way to capture a little bit of that, which is a much more generous and nice way of thinking about it. Of course, when it puts pilots in danger because they're getting their eyes zapped with laser pointers, it's a problem.
Well, I have a different take on that, Mona.
Okay. Go for it.
And it's something that I've stolen from the first philosopher I seriously studied and wrote about, namely Immanuel Kant, who famously said, and this is just about a direct quote, there are two things that fill me with ever increasing awe. You know, the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. And so rather than talking about miracles and magic, why don't we talk about awe and majesty, yeah. Right?
Yes.
Because that is a way of integrating the experience we're having with something that is ennobling.
Yes.
Right? Fantasy creating. Now, having seized the floor so unceremoniously, I'm going to return to the topic, you know, that I put on the table, namely the fact that there are two political parties and both potentially have agency. And one doesn't have to play the victim indefinitely. You know, when I am not a political philosopher or policy analyst, you know, I am a Democratic Party activist. And I am convinced that the Democratic Party finds itself in a situation now which is analogous to the situation that it found itself in after November of 1988. That is, without a clear path forward based on current arrangements, current premises, and policies, in need of a considerable makeover, details to come. For many years now, the party has operated on the thesis that its best path forward is to unify itself as it is. The thesis after 1988 was very different, namely that simply finding the point of equilibrium in the party as it now existed wasn't good enough to solve its problems. There needed to be new ideas and, let me be blunt about it, a factional fight, the sort of fight mm-hmm. that Donald Trump was willing to wage in order to change a party that he thought needed to be changed, whether rightly or wrongly. And I think you have to say that he had the courage of his convictions. He was willing to go up against everybody to change it. And he succeeded. Now, I'm not saying that the Democratic Party needs to be turned upside down, but it does need a good shaking. And a really interesting question that I'll be watching looking forward in especially in the next 2 years, which I think are going to be crucial, is to what extent my fellow Democrats share the view that something quite fundamental needs to change within the party. I think that the presidential primary that will begin the day after the midterm elections in 2026 will be of more than usual intellectual interest, because I suspect that there will be very different theories of the case put on the table as animating, you know, competing presidential campaigns. And what Gavin Newsom has to say, you know, will probably be quite different from what the governor of Pennsylvania has to say, or a bunch of other people who may put themselves forward. There's going to be a big debate about the relationship between the Democratic Party and the working class, not just the white working class, but as we now know, the working class as a whole. And, you know, and some people will argue that the party needs to get rid of its current attributes that are so off-putting to the working class. And others will say, no, that price is too high to pay, and we need to figure out how to construct a new majority consistent with what the current, you know, leaders of the party and leading factions and leading interest groups in the party are willing to tolerate. Stay tuned.
Bill, I have two questions for you,
yeah,
if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all. I love questions.
First question is, in between 1988 and 1992, the Democratic Party made a decision to move to the center, and Bill Clinton became the avatar,
yep,
the new covenant and all that. Okay. Do you think that's the path the party will take this time? And the second question is, there are people out there saying, well, look, the experience of the last 9 years has shown us that what the American people really respond to is outright demagoguery. And if the Democrats hope to win, they need to find a good demagogue on their side. So what do you say to both of those?
To the first, I say, it's a much more complicated discussion than simply repositioning the party along a left-right political spectrum.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that the center-left now doesn't have an organized view of how a modern economy can be made to work for the vast majority of the people who work within it. We don't. And we desperately need one. And I could, you know, nor have we figured out, this is not an original point with me, nor have we figured out as a party where to draw the line on a range of cultural issues, right? Because there is always room for reform. There's always room for expansion of the promise of American life, as laid out in the Declaration of Independence. But a party that can't say no is a party to which the American people will say no. And so I think we need to figure out and have a big debate about where those lines are and the lines that need to be drawn and then defended. I made a lot of people unhappy with the piece in the Wall Street Journal that I published yesterday about the travails of the modern university and what to do about it. But I intend to prosecute that case because I'm drawing the lines that I think need to be drawn against the excesses of the past decade.
Yeah.
How many people in the party will be willing to engage in that line drawing exercise? I have no idea. You know, all I'm doing is expressing the deep conviction that without significant change in the other major political party, the one that now holds the power will continue to do so. And that's not a prospect that cheers me.
Linda, I'm going to want to be introduced to your pet in a minute, but but I want to ask Damon if he wants to comment on what Bill just said and on the trajectory of the Democratic Party. You watch it pretty closely.
Yeah, I do. And I agree with pretty much everything Bill has said. My one thing I would add is I do think in the mix has to be two things that I didn't hear Bill mention, although he did mention one of them earlier, this issue, the theme of distrust and lack of confidence in our institutions. My line over the last year or so, as I was trying to give Biden advice in his attempted reelection that didn't actually turn out how I expected in any way, since he didn't even end up running. And I've made this in a couple of New York Times op-eds, has been that the party needs to put on the back burner any ambition to expand government. It needs to acknowledge the fact that there is not going to be any great public support for any expansion of government until people have greater trust and confidence that it can work. And the way to do that is to redefine the party more in terms of reforming the existing system and say, we hear you, American voters. We understand you think the government isn't functioning as well as it should. And this ranges from, you know, everything from kind of pandemic response to the outcome of our foreign policy to the fact that Amtrak in the most populous area of the country, namely the Northeast Corridor, can't seem to run its trains without a major snafu and breakdown for a week. You know, in all of these ways, I think the party should say to the American people, we hear you, we need to earn your trust back, and we're gonna do it. And here's our agenda. And this, my second point is that as part of that, they need to get angry. And I say that with a wink, a political wink, because it doesn't necessarily require that office holding or office aspiring Democrats are themselves literally angry, but they need to turn themselves into populist politicians who can actually channel the anger they hear in the electorate and convince the voters that they hear this discontent and they feel it. And again, I don't want to sound too cynical, but politics is in a way a game, and it involves mirroring what you hear in public opinion and then channeling it into office. And I think the party has sort of, what we got with the Harris campaign ended up being one theory of the case, to use the phrase that Bill uses a lot that I like. Her theory of the case was, we're going to have a kind of popular front from AOC to Liz and Dick Cheney, and we're the system party. The problem with that, even though ideologically speaking, I personally found that very appealing. I loved that convention. That was a great convention for Damon Lenker. The problem is that that isn't the mood of the electorate. The electorate does not. The electorate doesn't want to be, you know, voting for the party of the bipartisan system, because they're pretty angry with that bipartisan system. And it ended up reinforcing Donald Trump's message that he represents those misfits, those, the anti-system impulse. So my advice is, as I described it a minute ago, about repositioning the party as reformers, has to do with trying to shift that perception that the Harris campaign, I think, inadvertently emphasized, which is, if you don't like the system, you vote for Republicans. If you love the current, the status quo, you vote for the Democrats. I do think part of that was, you know, anger at inflation and immigration and the kind of general anti-incumbency thing that's been going on over the last couple of years. But it's bigger than that. The collapse in trust and confidence in our institutions has been underway for a long time. And it's only increasing, as Bill noted, with that recent Gallup poll showing the judiciary now also following all the other branches of the federal government in the spiral. So that's the only kind of bit of nuance or contribution I would add to Bill. All I'll say in our final podcast here on that subject is, if Bill can continue to have a real influence in a way that I never will, given that I'm not really like, I'm not a Democratic Party player. I'm an independent guy who writes about all kinds of stuff, and I've never worked for a Democrat at a high level. If Bill, with his ties and history and background and authority, can push this case, then that gives me some hope, because we need people like him doing that. I've noted, I think Rio Teixeira is another major person who is pushing in a similar direction. He, I hope, has an influence as well. So anyway,
that curb your enthusiasm, Damon, but we will try to rally the troops starting very soon.
Good.
All right.
Well, I'll be right there at your back with my vote in hand, ready to be cast.
And I would just note, though, as much as I do agree with everything you've said about the need for a rethink on the part of the Democrats, and certainly on the part of the Republicans, but we've been saying that for years. We also do have a tendency to overread
the results of every election. And sometimes, you know, it's as simple as people were upset about the price of eggs and the border. And when those things are no longer front of mind, all of these other things might fade away or not fade away, but fade. Let's put it that way.
So, can I just add in response briefly to that, that I hear you. It's true. We're talking about narrow margins, just a few percentage points this way or that. I would, though, remind people that those the data I mentioned about the collapse in confidence and trust in our institutions, the right track, wrong track numbers, all of them are going in the same direction. They have been going that way for a long time. That those are real phenomena, and they need to be taken seriously. And the last point, in 2016, I wrote a column for The Week in September of that year, headlined "Why Trump Will Lose in the Biggest Landslide in American History." And when I wrote that, I believed it because I looked at that guy and I said, there's no freaking way that guy is going to get any. I thought he'd get 38%, 40%. I was completely wrong. I've been following along for a long time. I was surprised that Trump picked up 11 million more votes, even while narrowly losing in 2020. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he ended up gaining even more and won a second term, I wasn't surprised this time, but to those who say the price of eggs is the big thing, yes, on a kind of like proximal level, that it was a major variable. But the fact that we now live in a country where these events could happen, where a guy like Trump could win, lose, and then win again in the face of that kind of bipartisan pro-system popular front kind of message that Harris gave shows that this is a real thing. It is real. It has support. Where, you know, all of the shifting of Latino voters toward the Republicans, some among Black voters, young people, young men. These are, you know, can the trends reverse? Yeah, you get a Barack Obama on the other side and everything seems possible. But short of a major world historical political talent like that, the trench warfare is going to be keeping this sometimes pretty toxic Republican Party either in office or close to office. And we got to figure out a better way to push back.
100% agree.
Thanks for indulging me.
Yeah, that's fine.
I would just, you know, in emphatic agreement with what Damon just said, our country, I think our history shows, works better when there is for a while a majority party that can sustain public support and carry through an agenda that not only works, but is seen to work by the people. And what we have lacked since the beginning of the 21st century is a stable majority party. And I think it has been demonstrated that this is not a formula for effective governance in the kind of system that we have. And nobody is, you know, nobody's gotten less than 46% or more than 53% during this entire quarter of a century. And there have been, by historical standards, many, many changes in control of one or both chambers of the legislature. And when we're fighting over narrow margins, we are not going to do well with the big questions, I guarantee.
Linda.
Well, this is our last show, so I want to do something a little bit different, and that is I'm not going to add to anything that Damon or Bill said. They're the experts in the Democratic Party. I will say, Mona, I don't know about you, but I am not ready to become a Democrat again. I was a Democrat in my youth. I'm not going back there. I am too conservative on too many issues, particularly economic issues, having to do with taxes and government spending. So I'm not going there. But I want to reflect a bit, since this is our last show, on what this show has meant to me and how much I am going to miss it. And I'm going to miss it precisely because of the kind of discussions that we just engaged in between Bill and Damon, exploring the future of the Democratic Party, exploring what changes have taken place in the United States. And I will say that my own take on that is what's happened is the people have changed, and it's not been for the good. You can blame Kamala Harris as the candidate. You can give some credit to Donald Trump as somebody who had a certain kind of charisma. But what worries me most is that I think there has been a degradation in the American voting public. They don't pay attention. They are not, and this is going to sound elitist, and so be it. I think we're going to see where this takes us. But I am going to miss these discussions. And I want to just say a little bit about what I'm going to be doing going forward. Maybe others will want to step in as well. I know Damon is going to keep writing and Bill is going to go take over the Democratic Party, I hope. I'm going to be turning away from politics, which I've spent most of my public career in, and turning back to my first love, which is literature. And I just want to notify our listeners, because I hope they will not only be listeners, but they will be buyers of a book that I have coming out in May of this year. It is my very first novel. It is called The Silver Candlesticks. You can look it up on Amazon. It is ready for pre-order. And it stems from my discovery in 2012 that when my family left Sevilla, Spain in 1597, it was probably because they were being pursued by the Inquisition. We were found records thanks to Henry Louis Gates and his show Finding Your Roots. We found records of my ancestors in the Inquisition files. And so I have spun a tale out of this. And it's not just a novel about the Inquisition and in the 16th century in Spain and about love and friendship. It also, I think, has something to say to those who are interested in anti-Semitism in the world, because anti-Semitism is often called the oldest hate. And we are experiencing an upsurge in anti-Semitism around the world, but most disturbingly to me here in the United States. So I hope people will order it. I will miss very much talking to all of you, listening to all of you, and learning from all of you. I will continue to have occasional things to say on my own Substack. So thanks very much, Mona, for this opportunity. It's been a wonderful 5 years.
Thank you for all of that, Linda. Thanks so much. And I look forward to reading your novel and to having you come back in May when it's published, and we will have a nice, in-depth, hour-long conversation about it.
Here. This is wonderful news. And it sounds like the perfect topic for you, too.
Yes.
Was it energizing and fun to write?
It was very time consuming. It took me 10 years. I read literally dozens of books about the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition. I know more about the Spanish Inquisition than anybody should know. And in fact, if you walk into my office and look at my bookshelves, you will think I'm a very strange person, because I have rows of books about North Korea and rows of books about the Spanish Inquisition, both of which have found their way into my life through my writing. I earned an MFA back in 2012 at George Mason and have published a number of short stories, many of them on North Korea, in Commentary Magazine and elsewhere.
By the way, there are some continuities between the Inquisition.
Yes, there are. There are indeed.
And on what we saw the past week about coming out of Syria. I mean, God.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anybody else have closing thoughts? Damon, you're going to be continuing to teach and write, I assume.
Yeah, I'll be at Substack, at Notes from the Middle Ground, and then teaching at Penn. But I'm also going to be working on a book of my own, not at all a novel. I'm writing a book about Leo Strauss, which Bill Galston might find interesting. My question is, how is it that this guy has had so much influence on American politics, ranging from on the left, Bill Galston, and maybe myself, all the way over to a lot of the kind of more sensible, never Trump conservatives like Bill Kristol and his father, Irving Kristol, to people like Michael Anton and his friends and Bronze Age pervert who got a PhD with Stephen Smith at Yale, who's a Straussian. How is it that Leo Strauss has managed to have such a wide-ranging influence? So it's a book about his thought and how one can understand the range of that influence. And I hope to make a real contribution to that, and in a way that will be accessible to more than just academic political theorists. So I'm writing that for Oxford University Press, and I'll probably take about 2 years to get it done.
Great. It sounds fascinating.
As the only, probably the only person on this show who ever took a course from Leo Strauss, I'd be happy to be interviewed by you, because I functioned in that world for a very long time. And I think I may be able to add something. So
great. I'd be happy to. I actually just the other day took a bunch of Strauss related books out from the library, one of which has an essay by you on, you know, what it's like to be a Democrat who studied with Strauss. So right. I'll be reading that.
You know, there's another essay in a volume that Stephen Smith, you know, edited. I think it was the Cambridge Companion to Leo Strauss, that talks about Strauss's, post-war reconciliation with liberal democracy and why he threw his influence on that side as opposed to some earlier tendencies. And while we're talking about books, I too have a book coming out next year.
Excellent.
And it's really a deep dive into political psychology. And the working title right now is that the, anger, fear, and the urge to dominate, and then there are words after the semicolon, of course, this being an academic book. But it's really an effort to take what we've seen in recent years and rooted in a deeper political psychology that takes us all the way back to the Greeks. Because in fact, there's nothing new about any of this, but we're being reminded of its persistence in our nature. Among other things, it's an argument with people who are optimists about human nature, which I long ago ceased to be. I find that it limits my disappointments considerably.
It's what made me a conservative. Pessimism about human nature. No, realism, let's call it.
Realism, but by the way, liberal realism of the post-war sort, which is now being much maligned by the likes of Samuel Moyne, was in fact a very powerful stratum of thought that I think had deeper, sounder foundations than a lot of what's passed for optimism since then, or so I believe.
100%. And let me emphasize to our viewers and listeners that you will be hearing again from both Damon and Bill, who will, I hope, return to discuss their books when they are published. And I look forward to that. And with that, I want to thank everyone for watching and listening. And I want to thank our producer, Jim Swift. Beg to Differ is signing off now for the last time.